Hello and welcome to Pair Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most Christmassy work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord. Pew, 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 pew.
Yes. But whether you're on the Discord or listening to this on your podcasting feed, This episode is coming out before our Reflecting on Arc 18 episode.
What?
I was so proud of us. We recorded our Reflecting episode the earliest we ever had.
Yeah. We were so on top of it.
It was going to be ready earlier than ever. But we ticked Karma off something serious, apparently. Anyway, there were a lot of technical difficulties.
Many technical difficulties.
That 2.5 hour recording has been lost to the spirits. It's on the paths somewhere.
It's going to show up. The transcribed version is probably going to show up in Verona's bookstore at some point.
So we're going to be re-recording that with our guests in a few days, but hopefully this time with less issues. But
stay tuned for that.
Yeah, keep a lookout for it next week, probably.
Yeah. Perfect. So with all the housekeeping done, let's get into it, shall we? We're starting Crossed with Silver, a very fun arc title. Should we talk about the arc title first?
Yeah, I mean, so that crossing with silver is when you
a fortune teller. You cross their palm with silver. That's the expression I know of from the most.
Never heard that before.
Never heard that? Crossing somebody's palm with silver is like paying, you know, it's a very, it feels like a very like tropey way of saying, pay me.
I've heard it in terms of like bribing someone. Oh, yeah. Like paying the ferryman. Yeah. Like more in terms of like paying someone to do something they're not meant to is definitely how I've heard it.
But, you know, speaking of ferrymen, obviously the other meaning of it is ferrymen. you have got to be careful of silver, and that kind of seems like it might be taking a front seat here, potentially.
I think a lot of people, like the second we start our like wintry arc and then it's called Crossed with Silver, I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, okay, Guillaume's finally going to come back to the fore. And he does.
Yeah. that's maybe what we're going to see. We'll see.
Hello?
Oh, hello. Can you
hear me? I think I dropped out for a second there.
Anyway. Yeah, so that's what we're going to be seeing. It'll be good times, I'm sure. Verona is the person that we start this arc with, and it begins with Verona welcoming visitors to her new potential magic bookstore.
Yeah, and I love how this this chapter really opens, because I think we all came into this kind of excited to see where our Kenneteers were at the like end of this time skip, right? Like, you know, the big thing after a time skip is we want to find out what's happened to the Kenneteers. And this chapter sort of opens with like people arriving at Verona's house and interrupting her morning routine. And it just doesn't faze her. Like, this feels like a real victory lap chapter for Verona in a lot of ways. Like, she kind of quickly looks around the house and is like, yeah, everything's as presentable as I need it to be. Like, just the whole vibe is like, Verona is in a good place. She's really put together. Stuff doesn't faze her. Later on, she's even telling Luna not to cheat and do her homework for her. She uses the term executive dysfunction, which is like a term I only became familiar with very recently and have seen mostly in the context of people using it to describe Verona. so it's just like, I feel like 19.1 really opens hard with this message of like, Verona, has come.
Verona's sorting it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and I agree. That's
the direction it was heading in Arc 18, but like, it really feels like it's a landing in this time skip.
Yeah, we started to see, obviously, that Verona's domain was kind of becoming this, I kind of want to use the word halfway house, although that has some problematic connotations, but it is literally a house on half street. So it feels like the story is asking me to use that term. For kind of miscellaneous folks. And it seems like, you know, obviously from various Kennets and all that jazz and Pagin and Squirrel and everybody, like, it seems like that's where it's headed and it's going really well.
Yeah. This is one of those topics that we talked about a fair bit, like Verona and her new like I think the term that was used was gaggle of girls that she surrounded herself with, and how they're all helping each other. And in fact, I think I was the only one when we recorded that who hadn't read 19.1, and now I see why everyone was talking about that like this, because it hits you so hard in this, how, like, you're right, this domain has become the center point for Verona to not just help herself, but surround herself with people who she vibes with in different ways, and, like, they're all helping each other. Mm. Like, that conversation with Mal in a bit, where Mal, like, is worried about Macaulay and, you know, tries her darndest not to let Verona acknowledge that, but, like, you know, she's worried about the emotional turmoil her friend is going through, and that's, like, such a big step for, you know, Mal.
Yeah. Yeah. It not only seems like these people are gravitating towards Verona's domain, but it's actually, like, it's actually really beneficial to everybody. Like,
yeah,
Verona
yeah.
is not only just kind of collecting these people, but actually actively helping them and seemingly helping herself as well.
Vice versa.
Verona was so disconnected from people, and this seems to have resolved that.
Yeah, it's like a mutually beneficial arrangement, and that's something Verona is, like, really cautious of. Every time someone comes in, like, you know, she's, like, with Luna and Shu here, she's like, I have to pay you. Like, she's very conscientious about making sure that, you know, that's not going either way. She's not just giving to other people, and that they're not just giving to her. And I think that's, you know, something we can thank her dad for, is that she's very attuned to making sure both people are benefiting from arrangements.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, should we talk about this bookstore, because I think it's very interesting, it's very Verona, it's a very good idea, but also, how much trash must be hidden amongst these books? Like, surely a lot of them are, because, you know, these are books that were never written, right? So I'm sure there's some good reasons why they were never written, but also one of the reasons why they were never written or never made it is because they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I feel like we see, like, bits of both. Like, there's the one where it's just the person's day at work that's, like, 500 pages and 125 of them are the trip to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And, like, that, but even then, I feel like the lesson for this stuff is, like, anything that you, like, everything is somebody's treasure. Like, even Luna is like, oh, I'd probably, like, skim parts of that because I'm trying to learn how, you know, the normal people do.
That's interesting. Maybe because while Bo is an author, there's a lens of, you know, even the worst book, there is value in writing books, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and I don't think Wabo has to worry about that so much. but yeah, no, there's definitely, this vibe of, like, there's an audience for everything. Like, there's I think there's one that's just, like, literally bullshit or something. And they're like, I mean, goblins would like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's the book about, like, how to have sex with a horror.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, like, they specifically call that out as, like, there's maybe five couples in the world that would apply to tops. But
yeah,
for those five, this is a super valuable book. Like, and that's sort of the vibe of this whole thing. And that's, like, the concept of lost stuff and, like, the can it found in general. Like, remember we saw in 18.A, Luna's birth, and it was all, like, she was the lost idea amongst lost things and misfound her and turned her into something really cool. And that's kind of what the bookshop is now. It's like, finding extremely dumb, pointless shit. And, like, you know, Verona wants to put it in the hands of the people who can use it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
But that's what her peddling, was it peddling? Like, the thing she wants to do where she, like, gets innocents to come in and find the perfect book for them.
Mm.
Which is just so, it's like that cursed bookshop trope.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Verona wants to do it in a good way.
Yeah, it's Needful Things, the bookstore. But
yeah.
Instead of Satan, it's Verona. I want to call out this bit where Mal attempts to maybe jokingly gainsay Verona, which obviously doesn't end up turning into anything. And maybe Mal and Verona know that it's not going to turn into anything. But reading this, I was like, that's surely too much, right? Like, I know Mal is too much in general, but surely that's too much, too much.
Yeah, it's funny because I suppose this is, like, the word equivalent of, like, you know how Mal's got that real, like, rough and tumble, you know, big brother vibe of, like,
yes,
you know, she's constantly tackling Verona or punching her and stuff.
Yep.
this feels like the word equivalent of that, but you're right. It feels harsher. And like, I don't know, part of me was like, oh, you know, riding the, oh, Verona is way more secure and comfortable now. You know, the concept of gainsaying used to freak her the fuck out. So part of me was like, oh, she's not even fazed. That's nice. But yeah, the other part of me was like, Jesus, Mal, calm down.
Yeah, it's too much. I think Mirthstrike in our chat put it well by saying, look, this gun that I'm pointing at you isn't loaded. Don't worry. Like, yeah, that's not, that's still not cool.
Like, yeah, like later on when we find out that she got a thing to get around the no violence law, like she got a permission slip to be violent specifically to Verona.
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny. That was a good joke. And like, I very much enjoyed that. This feels way more serious than that.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, anyway, I mean, it is funny how they're like, cause they're arguing like an intentionally subjective thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it seems like their relationship has gone quite nicely. And, you know,
yeah,
very nice. It's very nice that Verona has friends now.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't feel the need to talk about Verona and her gaggle of girls too much because I have a feeling we're going to do it again in our reflecting episode we already did it once in the reflecting episode. But I do want to call out that Shu is here because, you know, our dude shot his shot and now he and Luna are seemingly hanging out together. And I don't know if it's more than friends or whatever, but I was just like, you know, good on you, buddy. Like he was clearly after her in some fashion and it looks like they're hanging out as buds. So I see that as a win.
Yeah. Thumbs up. Making dreams come true while Bo is. Verona heads over to the community center to chat to Macaulay, bringing her to her house to get a bit of a buffer from her dad, and they talk about shitty families.
And we see Anthem briefly, and I'm curious, like, where you and the chat think Anthem is sort of landing on the whole, like, reformed to unchanged spectrum of what we thought. Yeah.
Because obviously he's, like, doing good here, right? Yeah. Like, he's doing the thing where he's teaching Macaulay and kind of being
and you get good vibes positive
figure. Yeah, exactly. You do get good vibes. But also, like, he's hinted that that's something that he was doing before anyway. So it's hard to point at that and say, like, that's a change because he has talked about how he did that before anyway.
I think that's the thing. Like, he was a really good dad when his daughters were doing, like, what he wanted, if that makes sense.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Which is not what being a good dad is, but, like, this is...
Yeah, but interestingly, this is Macaulay talking about,
yeah, you know, exactly,
breaking away from that, and he is being seemingly kind of good about it.
I was cautiously optimistic from the vibes I got from this.
Yeah, me too. Hard to come down too strongly, but kind of looks like it's actually working, which is good.
Yeah, like the fact that like he sort of says go hang out with Verona and Mal because they seem like people who are supporting you, and that's important. And he then is sort of like, you know, that's who Abraham Musser is for me, which, you know, is a little bit eye-rolly, but then also...
Wait, but we saw
in his
that
interlude.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, I think
we
that's
saw that
a valid
that was very
thing.
True.
So yeah, again, yeah. Like cautiously optimistic.
Yeah. I while we're giving kudos out, I want to give kudos to Verona for this very dangerous situation that she's handling very well with regards to like Macaulay confessing here that she is planning on murdering somebody. And Verona walks the line of like, not supporting that and very obviously not supporting that without pushing Macaulay away completely. Like,
yeah,
she really handles that pretty perfectly, which is not handling complex social situations with humans is not something that normally we would have praised Verona for, but she's doing really well.
So this almost reminded me of what Verona would have wanted Lucy to do back in their whole argument in arc 12 or 13 or whatever it was. Like, this is, that's the thing where like Verona isn't telling her what to do, but is making it very clear what she thinks of the whole thing. And she's saying, you know, this won't ruin us if you don't do it. But like, yeah, like she's not forcing her or giving her ultimatums. She's just like, this seems like a really dumb idea. You can't even tell me you'll do it. I'll still try to be your friend if we can't, but that's going to affect things. Like it's, and yeah, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, you know, we're going to see Lucy is a bit more like that now with Verona too. Like it just feels like the way Verona wants things to be handled for her. And I think Macaulay is the same in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think Verona is doing really well on this and deserves props.
Yeah, 100%.
So yeah, let's talk about what Macaulay is actually talking about here, which is basically like she doesn't know how she will live without her family. Or even more than that, with her family actively cutting her off or maybe hunting her down.
Yeah.
Like that's a big unknown that she's kind of seemingly overwhelmed by, which is very understandable.
Yeah, like I kind of related to her vibe, like of like feeling so useless. Like I remember when I was like moving out at 18 and I didn't know how to wash my clothes, and there's that vibe of like, you know, I think somebody who knows what they're doing, like Verona, is like, you just put them in the machine and push the button. But like, if you don't know how to do it, you kind of get put in front of the machine. And like, washing machines always have like 20 settings, of which you use maybe two. And but like, you don't, like, when you don't know what you don't know, you kind of look at this washing machine like,
Yeah, like,
because you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what parts matter and what parts don't. So like, I totally got Macaulay's vibe here, and like I agree that that would be terrifying. It's like, you, if you don't know how to take care of yourself, like, she seems like a smart girl, I'm sure with someone's help she'd pick it up very quickly, but like, you know, she's got to go through that process. And that's going to be hard to do, as you say, if her family is potentially hunting her down.
I don't know,
Macaulay's thing gets compared to Verona's quite explicitly. Macaulay's like, hey, speaking of like my shit, what are you doing with your dad? And it's kind of like two problems where I was like, I don't really know what the answer is here. Like Verona, when asked what her plan is with her dad, she's sort of like, I don't know, I guess in a few years I'll be free, and the domain is getting me to the point where that doesn't terrify me anymore, which is like, doesn't feel like a solution, but you know, is far better than any other option, right?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. I mean, you totally understand where Macaulay's coming from here. Like, it is a big thing. But doesn't mean that you should go along with murdering somebody, Macaulay.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like that in the right world, the answer is, hey, ask your parents or tell your parents, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And see if they're willing to explore that option. But like, you know, Macaulay's not willing to do this because I think we all know the answer is they're probably not going to go along with that.
Not without
serious incentive to do so.
Yeah.
I don't envy someone like Macaulay.
Yeah. It's a rough situation for sure.
I just wanted to call out the part where Brett like comes into the room and is like, Verona's like, hey, we're talking about something important here. And he just sort of steamrolls over her. And then Macaulay yells at him. He's like, she said we're talking about something fucking important. Like, get the fuck out. And it's just such a good moment for, like, someone else validating what Verona's saying. Because, like, the big thing that we constantly complain about with Brett is that he just doesn't listen to Verona. Mm-hmm. And so, like, getting somebody else to just be like, no, 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 what she's saying is correct. Fuck off. Was just such a nice moment.
Yeah, no, it was fun to just have Brett. And what can Brett do in that situation, right? All he does is kind of awkwardly close the door and back away. And what else could he do? It's an unwinnable situation for him, and it was very fun.
Yeah, because, like, the other side of this is his whole thing relies on, like, the fact that, you know, he has that power dynamic with Verona, and as his dad is entitled somewhat to boss her around or whatever. But you can't do that with
Macaulay, this,
you know, random girl she's brought home, especially, you know, I don't think he realizes, but who could murder him in a second? Maybe that's the solution. We fix both problems. We make Brett the person.
Make Brett Macaulay the person who gets murdered. Yeah.
It's foolproof and ethical.
Yeah, no, 10 out of 10 idea. Verona and co. Watch the skiers arriving, and they're joined by Lucy and some other students. And what a fun moment this is.
Yeah, because we haven't really talked about it, but like something the chapter has been doing since the start was saying, like,
yes,
they've come, you know, they're here.
They're arriving, yeah.
And it's this fun little bit of tension because you're kind of like, who's they? Like, is it a group of practitioners to do something? Yeah. Is it Charles's others? Like, I was going through big answers, yeah. And then it's like this great delivery on it where it's this nice relief moment of, oh, it's the skiers. And that comes with so much baggage for the story in so many ways too.
Yes, and I love that. Like, we immediately know what that means, which is like, this is literally life being breathed into the town, right? Like, we've known for a long time, Kennet is a shithole. Oh, it kind of goes okay when the skiers are here. And we hear that this is a bumper season as well, seemingly like a really, not just normal, but slightly more than normal crop of influx of skiers.
Yeah. And that's a real personal moment of pride for Verona and Lucy, because if Charles had his way, it wouldn't be happening. And that way they made this happen. So there's like the vibes of like, God, this town's a shithole, but it's our shithole and we made it survive. Like, it's just this moment of like, we did this and it's so good for them.
Yeah. But then obviously it's kind of immediately tinged with the idea of like, well, Liz is the town. Like, this is what I thought of, like, oh shit, this is awesome. Like, the town's got life. Oh wait, Liz is the town. Oh wait, like, this is going to be like, the town's going to be really busy. Like, that now the Kennedys are going to have to deal with all of this shit, like, and we immediately get into that. But yeah, it's this interesting, like, yeah, it just lands so successfully.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how Liz copes with a bunch of vagrants coming into town for a couple of months, because, you know, with all her FOMO stuff, I can really see her not liking all the visitors because she doesn't fully grok them. I don't know.
Mm.
But also, it presumably comes with some sort of boost to her in some fashion. Like, we saw one of the Kenponents back in the day was KT, the young, hip snowboarder guy who was just not really doing anything in the summer. So it's an important aspect of the town, and it has to matter to her.
Yeah.
I just love this as a moment of seeing all these skiers and like the victory moment for the Kenneteers. On top of that as well, like, Lucy obviously shows up, and there's this like really interesting moment where like Verona and Lucy have sort of arrived with their group of friends. Like, Verona's here with Macaulay and Mal, and then Lucy's arrived here with like Wallace and George and Mia. But they still share a moment, because it's like, they're the two who know that, you know, they made this season happen, and they're the two who really appreciate how much this means. And it's this great moment to encapsulate this idea of like what we've been talking about for, you know, years now at this point, which is that how they've grown apart and become independent people, but there's still like a really strong special connection between them. They're surrounded by their other friends, and that's who they're primarily hanging out with, but that doesn't lessen what they mean to each other.
I think they're getting into a good place with that, for sure.
I think as both of them get to better places in general, they're getting better at accepting this idea of growing apart, but not in a way that hurts things.
Verona now handles some chores with an influx of people. The town has more energy, and there's new folks to check out, including a racer spirit, a sad looking echo, and then kind of visiting Toad and doing a few other chats.
I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff here. I particularly like the chat with Toady, because he's talking about, you know, she's talking about not rushing the bookstore, and he sort of weighs in on that, which was funny because obviously he ended up having to rush his market out. And just in general, this chapter brings up, I think there's also a mention of another store that the guy who helped Bracken and Bag escape is opening. And there's like this vibe of like a handful of weird, magical, kooky stores and markets are opening in this town. And I love that all the owners are friends, and I'm getting ready to see this like magical commerce network of Kennet pop up.
Yeah. I mean, like, Kennet being the place where you find the store where you buy something and then you turn around and the store is gone. Like, I can totally imagine that being what happens to Kennet, right?
Toady, I think, originally had this vision for Kennet as the market of his eighth court.
Yes.
But now it's like, it's clearly moved beyond that. Like, he's talking about using Verona as a way to get some people in and out of that market in certain situations. Like, he's already shifting his vision so that the market is just, you know, a staple of Kennet's shopping mall of weird magical shit. And I just love that. Like,
yeah,
it's not just a gobble market for goblins or Verona's bookshop for innocents. It's also you know, some weird shop in Kennet found where practitioners might come. Like, it's for all sorts of people, and that's so fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a very fun concept, and I think it will mean that hopefully Clem will come in town and set up her own stall, because she certainly could.
Yeah. She should move here, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so finally the gang has a dream catch-up. Unfortunately, it's going to be their last dream catch-up for a while, because Santa interrupts.
Sorry, before we just skipped a section of the notes I really wanted to talk about. In that bit where we jumped through all the different chores that Verona was doing with all the groups, I really wanted to call out how great a reflection that is of, like, the chapters we used to get from Verona, like, which would dip through a bunch of different, like, silos of her life when she wasn't coping and focus on how bad all of them were. Like, do you remember this chapter, which would be like, oh, here's a section with Jeremy and it doesn't go well, and then she hangs out with Tash and that's also awkward, and then, you know, there's one with her dad, which is obviously terrible, and then, you know, then we'd go back to Lucy and there was still awkwardness after the fight. Like, we'd go through this whole thing of Verona's silos of her life as they're all crumbling, and when she was in a really bad space, it was like, oh, this isn't working. This feels almost way more Avery-ish, where we're jutting through a bunch of different places where she's going well, she's interacting with people and doing well. Like, it's such a turnaround. This is what really gave me that victory lap vibe that I brought up earlier. Like, she is now just moving through a bunch of things and people and places, and it's all just going well.
Yeah. It is, even though it's busy, it seems to be going well. I don't know. I kind of get this vibe of, like, I worry that there's going to be something that gets overlooked by us/the Kenneteers if we're having a lot of things to do. But I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it's all just going to go well and everything will be happy.
Oh, I'm sure it won't be, like, fully smooth sailing, but, like, the way it feels like Verona is able to cope with bumps in the road now compared to how it worked. Like, before, it was like, oh, bump in the road, better create a new silo. And then as soon as it got a bump in the road, it was like, oh, panic, better create a new silo. there's really a vibe to this one of, like, Verona just has better structures so that she can zip through all these things and they're all, like, boons to each other rather than the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
So, when the bumps come, hopefully she's better equipped now, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah. But yeah, so the gang has their dream catch up. Santa interrupts it, unfortunately.
Fuck the Sable for, like, letting this happen. Like, Charles,
the
was
judges,
like,
are really kind of letting Charles run wild, huh?
Yeah, which, like, Charles told us they were doing a while ago. I remember he said, oh, the charges signed onto this because I came in day one with a plan, blah, blah, blah. But I'm still like, man, like, fuck those guys. They did nothing, and now they've, like, weaponized their doing nothing into letting Charles do stuff. It just sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so no more nightmare conversations. Feels like the fight against Charles is definitely coming to a head. You know, it's hard to tell where we are in this story at the moment, but it definitely feels like this chapter felt like Verona was thinking, okay, you know, we can't talk anymore, so we gotta do it. It's time, you know, time to go kind of vibes.
Yeah, like, arc 17 was obviously our big fight against, like, Musa, and obviously that didn't, like, end, but, like, arc 18 felt a bit like the recovery from that.
Yeah.
And then 19 is like, okay, now we're starting to move in, you know, this is the arc 15, the arc 9, the moving into the next focus, which is a bit more Charles. And, yeah, I mean, so their only option now is the paths, right, to get away from Charles and actually be able to communicate. Like, it's a good thing Avery brought up that she's going back to the promenade. I think Verona and Lucy need to find an excuse to go there too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure they'll find an excuse.
But yeah, it's a fun thing. Like, the dreams have been the one thing they've had for the last five arcs, and now that's gone. It's a very fun way to kind of raise the stakes.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. So, sorry. Yeah, Verona has, like, she all but confirms here, right, that her plan is involving rethinking the structure of the judges, which I think was a popular theory after 18 dot whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just, I guess we talked about this a little bit again in that Lost Reflecting episode. but it's really interesting to think, like, this is such a great, like, teaser for a plan, because there's so many avenues it can go. Like, Wobbo giving us the hint that Verona is sort of rethinking the whole ball game is, like, enough of a teaser that I don't feel like we're getting shit kept from us unnecessarily, but there's so many directions you can go with that. Like, is she thinking four different roles? Is she thinking, what is she thinking is the alternative? There's 100 possibilities, and that's so fun to think about.
Mm.
Like, I almost, it feels like it needs to be a discussion question or a predictor category. Like, what do you think needs to replace the four judges?
Yeah. It feels like a good discussion question, I think. I don't know. I don't know. I can't even think of anything.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many ways you could take that. Because I remember we heard in, like, when we first got introduced to the idea of judges, that other places, the judges have different domains. Like, it doesn't have to be, you know, violence, death, commerce and innocence or whatever. Like, it can be four different categories. So is Verona just going to aim for a different set of four? But also, just, yeah, part of me was like, I'm so much more okay with her fucking over all four of the judges while the other three have just sat there and let Charles do this shit. Nothing. Like,
yeah,
you know, they're sitting there and Charles is like, some of the judges are sick of your shit. And it's like, man, if they think they're sick of her shit now, like, she's planning on unseating all four of them. Good riddance.
I kind of think, I'm trying to think if there's a way to tie in the kind of council organizational structures in Kennet into what these judge positions could be, like, as a way of seeing, like, Kennet as the seed idea for this. Like, you know, we've got the kind of three parts and the sub councils, and I'm trying to think if there's, like, a way to divide that amongst the four judges, but I'm not seeing anything there. But I feel like that could be thematically a nice link if we're able to make those mirror. I don't know.
I mean, I guess, like, this is the thing, right? Like, with any of these sorts of, when trying to design systems like this, you either, like, the thing with the judges is they don't get anything done because they're essentially drowned in, like, the rules and the bureaucracy and trying to maintain the status quo. Yes. But if you give people the power to do more, then all you need is one fuckwit to Charles it up, right? So it's like, that constant war of building a system between, like, drowning in bureaucracy or giving people too much power, which corrupts them. Like, how do you navigate that? Because something like a council that potentially just adds more weight to the judges that will slow them down, but also would make them less isolated, which is part of the problem. So I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's an interesting one, and we'll have to see how this plays out in the future. I don't feel bad about not knowing how it's going to work, because it doesn't seem like even Lucy knows how it's going to work, and Lucy is theoretically Verona's best friend.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised to learn that even Verona is still like,
how it would work. Yeah.
You know, like when she took Kennet Found to Avery, it was still very much this idea of, hey, but what if we chucked lost shit at Kennet? And the two of them, like, kind of took it from there. And, like, I wouldn't be surprised to learn that Verona's thing is very much still on the stage of, like, what if we rethought what the judges are? And she hasn't really gotten further than that.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, let's get into 19-2, shall we? We're with Lucy. Lucy and Bracken head over to train with Guillemet. And Melissa's there too, but doesn't really last very long. But gives it a good old try. Good on you, Melissa.
Yeah. I just still enjoy how thirsty she is for Bracken. Like, yep, she's gone about how much fun she loves fairy magic because they're all getting told to put less clothes on. Like, it's just, she's such an idiot. I love it.
Yeah.
This is very much, you know, what we talked about before. Like, Guillemet, you're sort of like, okay, yeah, Guillemet, you know, this is the start of the winter arc of the story. Guillemet is going to be a thing here. And this chapter certainly doesn't disappoint.
Yeah. Yeah, we get a bit of Bracken wanting to eschew labels here, which is fun. And it's interesting to track Bracken's growth and see, like, what he's turning into. I almost see him turning into, like, almost a, you know how Daniel Alitzer, was that his name, was a glamour drowned, was very, like, fey trickery-ish, whereas Bracken feels almost like a little mini Guillemet in the sense of this kind of, like, stoic warrior type. Heroic stoic warrior. I don't know if that's a summer glamour drowned version or something.
He does very much vibe with, like, Guillemet's whole big warrior boy aesthetic, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. So I quite like seeing him become this, like, semi-fey, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because he's definitely got that, like, streak of goblinism to him that comes with being from the Undercity.
Yeah. But he's also very protective of Bag and like kind of stoic. Like he gives me, you know, heroic, stoic war. that kind of vibe.
Yeah, I mean, like, even here, he can't really admit to Lucy that he has feelings. Like, when she's like, I don't want to hurt your feelings. He's like, you didn't hurt my feelings.
Yeah, I don't have feelings. I'm a boy.
But then, yeah, he has this, like, yeah, real philosophical moment where he's just like, oh, labels, what do they mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really interesting to sort of see where he's going to go with all this. Because the label thing is, like, fun because that's, like, that's what Kennet is all about, right? Not letting people get boxed into labels. But then, I mean, that's also the part that they agree with Charles. Like, Charles created the Undercity specifically to be, like, the place where people weren't locked into shit that the Seal did. So it's like, you know, him exploring that is also the part of, like, that's the overlap between Kennet and Charles, is they both agree that people shouldn't have to get boxed in like that.
I love the power that they learn here, not being able to feel the cold. Quite a fun one.
God, I could have used that this week. I don't know if it hit you guys down in Sydney, but, like, it's been so cold here this week.
Yeah, no, it's been freezing cold here.
Yeah.
So I would love this power.
Yeah. Of all the weeks to read about the ability to just not feel the cold, I was like, oh, I need that. I need that this week so bad.
Yeah, please.
I guess it's worth going out here too. Obviously, like, the two main students Guillemet has here is Verona and Lucy. And I thought that's really fun because, like, Guillemet's students were always Lucy and Avery. And then Verona was always much more like Team Marisica. And so it was just really fun to think. Like, I think it's very deliberate that Wabo, now that Guillemet's in winter, he's vibing more with Verona and Lucy and, like, not so much Avery. And obviously part of that's practical. Avery lives in a different city and, you know, he's offering to teach Verona a new type of magic. So, of course, she's, you know, knocking down the door. But, it just makes sense to me that now he is still vibing with Lucy but also more vibing with Verona than he used to now that he's in winter. Like, I think the idea of, like, his winterfication aligning a bit with, like, how Brett is has been talked about in the story. And so it's just like it sort of feels right that, you know, Lucy has been touched by, you know, people like Guillemet turning to winter and losing all of her other father figures, and there's this winter affiliation with her in that sort of regard. And Verona's got her dad, and so the two of them being the ones to learn winter glamour and how to manipulate that just feels right. Whereas obviously, Avery's off in a new city, you know, gallivanting around, like, being very summery. So she's the one still with the rose. Like, she very much vibes with who Guillemet used to be, not who he is now.
Yeah. Man, poor Guillemet. I mean, like, you feel it. You feel it a lot in this chapter, don't you? His winter descent.
Yeah, he talks about how it would be kind of nice if all of them failed as his students, because then he could just start hibernating and only coming out when he's really needed, which, like, has this real vibe of, like,
so tragic.
Yeah, like, existence is just painful for him all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the thing that we get into winter glamour more over the course of this, but, like, it is about forming those habits. And we kind of know, Guillemet has talked about this before, on, like, how he, as he does stuff, he's setting the expectation that that's all he can do, right? And he's like setting those ruts for himself to have to exist in. But you seeing how winter glamour works more tangibly in this chapter, it really helps to contextualize that and make that land even more so for me. Like, it is small deaths. It almost feels like cutting neurons, cutting your ability to learn and slowly losing every, you know, neural pathway that you have until eventually you can just do one action over and over again. That's tragic.
Yeah, I mean, this is the curse and the blessing of winter, you know, this chapter talks about, is that it makes you really good at the few things that it lets you still do.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I think that's why it's so great that, like, suddenly Verona is somebody he's vibing with, because like, Verona and her concept of being locked into a single path and, like, ending up like her dad or in her dream, like, the concept of falling to winter is something she's struggled with the human equivalent of. And so, of course, you know, he's able to connect with her in this new way and help her weaponize it. Like, you know, she instantly sort of vibes with like choosing the part of it that she wants to choose in a really fun way. I love this transition to, as Gilmaze turned to Winter, he's kind of swapped Avery out for Verona in a way that feels very tied into what winter versus summer means for a fairy.
We then flash to the other thing that we're going to see a lot of in this chapter, which is Lucy doing a very different kind of glamour training with Toad, and he's showing her the glamour he's created, which is goblin glamour.
No, don't call it that, Ruben. It's visceral glamour.
Sure, sorry. Visceral glamour. So first of all, a fun setup for the chapter, bouncing between these two with increasing rapidity. But I also just kind of love the vibe that Lucy has in her combat now, which is like fae / goblin duelist, you know? It's just a really fun specialization.
I mean, the story actually called that out back in like arc 3. Like, people were saying she was halfway between fairy and goblin, or had a weird mix of the two. Like, it's been there the whole time. It's just really coming to the fore, especially in this chapter, I guess. But you're right. I love the juxtaposition, like the way it's played off. Like, when they entered Gilmaze's cave at the start of the chapter, he was all like, you know, take off all the warm clothes. You know, you have to be really uncomfortable. That's the point, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, like, Toad's always like, oh, please come in, make yourself comfortable, and like points her to stools covered in like glass shards and needles. And it's just like, I love that for like, that's the complete opposite way of getting to the same end goal. Like, both of them kind of left her intensely uncomfortable, but one of them was very sort of like, you know, unapologetic about it, and in the completely opposite ways. It was just such a fun juxtaposition.
Yeah.
And like, that's what this chapter really does so much to establish, the lens through which Toadstool's Eighth Court stuff really holds up. Like, the way it is very, Winter is all about closing doors and doing one thing right, whereas goblins are very like, you know, throw spaghetti at the wall, like layer yourself in 10 layers of shit glamour as opposed to one strong one. Like, you really sort of see why Toadstool was able to come up with this theory that they kind of are the opposite to Winter.
It's interesting. I don't know. Yeah, the fae goblin dichotomy, to me, I want to see more of. I feel like it hasn't quite landed in my brain yet. You know what I mean? I do like it conceptually, though.
Yeah, the way I've thought about it for a long time, and this is like a reductive summary version. Like, there's nuances that you lose, but like, I see goblin versus fairy as being like an exploration of nature versus nurture. Like, goblins are sort of meant to represent the, you know, things that we think are human nature, like, you know, all this grossness and the visceral natural parts of us, and then fairy are, you know, the lies we tell ourselves, or the like the shit we dress ourselves up in, the nurture. I think the Eighth Court is such a fun idea because it feels like Toadstool exploring the idea that some of these things that we just think are nature and are inevitable and natural, like, maybe kind of aren't that and are a little bit nurture. Like, and Toadstool is such a great example of that, because his sort of goblin-y thing is this businessman, like, you know, greedy corporate sort of shtick, which, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, that, you know, capitalism's the natural way. Like, you know, it's natural for, you know, people to be greedy and screw everyone over. And Toadstool is kind of challenging that by admitting that, like, this line between nature versus nurture isn't like a big strong line. It's like things kind of bleed between the two. And like, the Eighth Court is kind of the opposite. Winter is like the final end goal of where things become set and stagnant. Whereas like, you know, nature isn't this set thing of like, these are the things that are natural. It's like where new shit can come from. Yeah, so I don't know. I guess that's sort of how I see it working. It's the Eighth Court and Toadstool are challenging this idea that some things are nature and some things are nurture, because, you know, it's not always so clear cut. There's not this line that divides the two.
Yeah. I guess that makes that. I like that. I think that makes sense.
The Eighth Court to me is Toadstool is sort of saying we can, you know, a lot of the nature that we think is nature is us dressing up what is actually nurture, which, you know, like so many things I think people assume, and you see this in like psychology papers, people will be like, you know, oh, people naturally X, Y, Z. And it's like, yeah, but do they do that because humans do or because they grew up in a society that did that?
Yeah.
And I think that's what the Eighth Court represents, is it's the goblins who came out as kind of goblin-y because, you know, that's what people thought is the nature, but really they're growing into that niche. It's not, they didn't come out fully formed like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the thing that I have a hard time kind of, I do agree with that, but I haven't conceptualized it as much, I think, is because like the whole point of pale is that that's every other, right? Like every.
Exactly. Yeah.
So kind of arbitrarily saying, and then that's why goblins fit as the Eighth Court doesn't quite work to me in that way. Like,
well, so I guess I to maybe challenge Toadswallow a little bit, I don't think all goblins are the Eighth Court. Like, I think to some degree, there will always be goblins who are very nature-based and goblins. Like he's more saying, I think the Eighth Court represents not just saying, oh, that's the gross nature of things and it can't be changed, right? Like that's nature, that's how it is, that's fine. The Eighth Court is sort of something say, yeah, this is like somewhat based in how we're born and is somewhat natural, but that doesn't mean it can't grow and can't be nurtured. Adjusted.
Yeah.
And like that fits in so much with what Toadswallow has been doing with people like Biscuit. Like he's taking goblins and helping grow them in a way that is like deliberate and positive and not just like, you know, big goblin good, which is, you know, the very naturally ordered way.
Yeah. Okay.
So I see the Eighth Court as being an aspect of goblinhood, like not for all of them, but for the ones who are like, want to take that part of nature and nurture it in a specific way.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I see what you're saying. I do like the visceral glamour, the literal layers to it, and the way it's so good in a scrap. Like, I think it's very fun.
it's so perfectly, like goblin in every way. Like the fact that, don't build one strong layer of glamour, build 10 ones filled with bugs. And then while they're freaking out because they cut through your bug layer, like stab them with a rusty fork. Like, it's just so fun.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see Lucy continue to like balance these two, because that's the really fun thing about this chapter, is like you're alternating between Guillemet being like, use this powerful glamour and close doors, and then Toadswallow being like, fucking open all the doors, keep them all open, shove them full of weird shit. And like, how do you do both of those things? Because it feels like that's where Lucy's heading, but I don't know what that means.
Yeah, yeah. So we jump back. So we're kind of going to be jumping back and forth this whole chapter. But we jump back to being back with Gil, and we're learning more about winter glamour here and its kind of special brand of permanence.
Yeah, and so this is where Bracken leaves us. And
yeah,
I just wanted to go at this hilarious moment where like Lucy and Verona are like, oh, you should go, you know, catch up with Melissa. And he's like, oh, I don't want to bother her. And Verona's just like, she wants you to bother her, bro. Like, and like Lucy's giving him tips on like how to open a conversation. He's like, I don't think so. I think I'd be getting in her way.
Mm.
And like, he just leaves. And just his continued complete obliviousness.
Do you think, is this an intentional obliviousness? Like, is he just avoiding the conflict by pretending to be oblivious?
I wondered that, but I don't get that vibe. I don't think Bracken is the sort of person to be sneaky like that. Like, he doesn't seem like the sort of person who'd put on that sort of thing. Like, he'd just be straight up like, I'm not into you, if he understood that that's what she was doing, I think.
Mm.
I think he's genuinely just an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough, I suppose.
As Waterfall mentions, all the Undercity girls are very direct. We've seen them like fight and drag boys away. True. So like, Melissa might just be being too subtle for him, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because she's not being very subtle.
But yeah, I mean, as we touched on before, like the whole, this section where we see winter glamour and how it locks you into a rut is really landing for me the tragedy of Guillemet even more aggressively.
Yeah, because like and just the concept of winter here, it's such a great like microcosm for like the practice in general, which fairy always tend to be. But like this idea that, yeah, like winter glamour is like more powerful because it locks you in. Like, that's that's just what, you know, Verona has been dealing with since the start of the story, is she didn't want to pick a lane, but also you get so many benefits from picking the lane. Like, if you're willing to pick lanes, stuff like Winter Glamour is so powerful, but it closes so many doors.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, I don't know. I agree with Lucy's reluctance to use Winter Glamour that much.
Yeah. I think I'd be very hesitant to use it as well, because it's just, it's just a good encapsulation of the practice. I can't get over this idea of like, yeah, do it and it'll go really good, but also you've shut yourself off from so many other things now. That's so great.
So yeah, we're flashing between Toad and Guillaume more and more, and kind of learning more, until these teachers ask Lucy questions about who she is and what she wants and what she fears, and she doesn't really have answers yeah. ready for that, which is interesting. Like, because this is something that Lucy has struggled with a bit, is like, and related to her role in the Carmine overthrowing, she doesn't know, she doesn't have a, in 5 years, where do you want to be kind of thing, you know? Like, she doesn't quite know exactly what she wants. She just knows what she doesn't want. And it's, I mean, normally for a 14-year-old, that's fine. But for Lucy, she's being put in the situation of kind of needing to make these decisions, right? And I don't think she wants to.
I just also think Lucy is the kind of person who doesn't do well without a goal. Like, I remember we used to talk about this so much. She was the Canateer who dove really into solving the conspiracy in Arc 1, because, like, she's, I think she's quite a goal-oriented person. That's why she's our candidate above witch. Like, she works well in these sorts of systems. And I think up until now, the thing for her in the story has been finding this, like, balance and peace within herself, and, like, not giving into her anger, but learning, like, when to fight and all that. Like, we've talked about that to death. And I think she sort of found that stability now and is in kind of a good place. And you're right, that's left her with, like, okay, the next step is good. Like, now you're sort of okay with yourself and you're in a stable place. Where do you go from here? And it's sort of this, like, okay, now what thing? And I think Lucy's realizing, unlike the other two, she doesn't have, like a career goal in mind, I guess. And, you know, not that there's too much pressure to figure that out when you're 14, as you said, but, like, I think for Lucy's own mental health, she'll want to at least have some idea in mind.
Yeah. I mean, like, it keeps coming up, right? And she still doesn't have these answers for it. And you need to have some answers.
Yeah. She's just not going to be comfortable bumming around for a few years, like, not working towards something, I think. Like, that's just not who Lucy is. And this, they tie this into a really fun way with, like, her finding a replacement for Charles. Like,
yes,
Lucy goes straight from realizing she doesn't know what she wants to do with her life to sort of being like, also, I haven't been able to find a thing for Charles. And, like, Lucy and Avery seem to be, Verona and Avery seem to be going well in their plans. Meanwhile, I'm just here, like, I don't have one. And then apparently Verona wants to, like, flip the script, and I don't even know what that means. Like, like, this whole thing almost reminds me a bit of the conversations we've had about the war mages in Moss's camp. Like, you know, talking about what do you do when you're, like, when your society is built off war mages. And then when you, like, if Master had finished and conquered Ontario, what do you do when you've got all the violent practitioners as, like, your leads? Like, how do they fit into his tiered, like, structure? And, like, Lucy feels kind of like that. Like, she's gotten trained, she's a fighter now, she can keep the peace and do what she needs to do, but she doesn't relish the fighting, she doesn't want to fight for fighting's sake. So now she's kind of like, shit, what do I do now? And the way that ties into figuring out her role within the group and within the plan to unseat Charles is just such a fun connection.
I think I agree. It's all about Lucy not quite knowing the future, not quite setting a goal for herself.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to think what I think she might drift towards. And, like, the only thing I can really think of is, like, you know, her and Booker have obviously both tossed around these ideas of, like, you know, obviously they're both very politically justice-y focused. And we've seen, like, Lucy later on in this chapter, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but she does use Winter Glamour to commit to making her, like, multi-fox form, which is this, like, very... Victoria Dallin way of being like, you know, I won't just limit myself to one thing. So like she commits herself using winter glamour to being able to be different things. Forget Viggy Dallin. It's a great mirror to Anthem and the way he had his seven echoes of himself, of his ways of doing violence. She made a trio of her own. But like, you know, I guess just with this focus on like being able to fight in different ways, being able to like have it, like her curses are this like thing of justice, and like, you know, the politics and fairness associated with all the justice. I kind of almost see her being this like, I mean, the word judge is the only one I can think of, but like, you know, the person you sort of call in to like, Lucy feels like the person is like, when there's a problem, you send her in and she like sorts shit out and makes sure it's all fair.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I don't know quite what that looks like, but you know, like less emphasis on fighting. She can fight, you know, dickheads when she needs to, but it's almost more like some sort of consultant of fairness. Yeah, like a bit like a mediator.
Yeah.
I don't know what that.
I don't know exactly what that. Yeah, exactly. But I feel it could work. We just need to.
But it's like it feels like in my head, it's like something closer to being like some sort of political position, but just, you know, because it's Lucy with the ability to, you know, beat fuckwits down if that is required as part of the politics.
Yeah.
But, you know, like a politician who's a black belt, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we move on, I also want to call out, they talk about, you know, using Guillaume's winter glamour to like lock themselves into certain transformations and stuff. And Verona brings up that, you know, she wants to be able to turn into a cat with ease with the winter glamour.
Mm.
And Guillaume's all like, you know, treat this like one of the big rituals, take time to consider, blah, blah, blah. And then Lucy sort of juts in and adds, you know, maybe take like days or weeks to consider it and ask Avery and ask the parents and we do research and all this stuff. And Verona sort of like sighs, but then she's like, okay, fair. Mm. And I guess, you know, last chapter we talked so much about how Verona was growing and this felt like another moment of that where like, you know, that would have sent Verona down such a thought spiral five arcs ago of like, Lucy doesn't trust me, I'm shit, like blah, blah, blah. Whereas now, like, you know, Verona's like a little disappointed that she can't impulse permacat herself, but she's secure enough now that she can be like, okay, you know what, that's fair that you have these concerns. And that's just, again, like a huge turnaround from where she used to be. Props to both of them for growing in this way, I think.
We then get into the final segment of this chapter, which is Lucy goes to chat to Rook and Reggie/Yen and Grandfather are there, and they talk about a new threat that's entered the town. So they head to track down this threat and deal with it. And obviously we were just thinking about Carmine replacements and then suddenly Grandfather's here. And, you know, Lucy even thinks this same thing, I think, of like, you know, Grandfather's kind of my backup, but doesn't feel like a good one. And it's just clearly such a bad idea. Like, Grandfather's clearly such a bad replacement candidate because, like, he's just being picked because he's similar to John. And remember, we didn't want John to be the Carmine either. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I remember having this conversation, like, when Lucy was talking about him being her choice, like, in arc 15 or whatever. Like when she first brought it up, I remember us both, like, being on the same page as being, like, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, you know, there's no one better, but, like, he's not a good choice.
Mm.
It kind of seems like Lucy is on that page now as well. Like, it's, he's a choice because he's around, not because he's actually a good
candidate.
Yeah,
exactly right. Exactly like, right.
You know, this comes down to the thing of like, maybe it's just the Carmine role is a dumb one. And this obviously comes into what Verona's cooking up from the scenes of it.
Yep.
But yeah, no, it is just funny how Lucy's had like 4 months at this point to kind of get Grandfather where she wanted him to be. And now we like come back to Grandfather as a candidate. It's like, gee, it's just not really working, is it?
Mm. Yeah.
And Holo Yen, Reggie's gotten an upgrade. This is a really fun product of the time skip is getting to see, he's taken on a new name.
Yeah. In his Oni training, he's becoming more and more Oni, which is very fun to see.
Yeah, it's so fun to see the don't tell them I said this, but the practice of somebody becoming an Oni.
How dare you?
I googled like what like yen means, because like I was sure it had a meaning aside from obviously like the Japanese currency. And it does, like, yen is like a strong desire. So like the idea of him being hollow yen is like this hollow desire or predisposition is like this is a very fun name for like what Reggie originally was, and I can't wait to see where he goes from here.
This is a crossword word that I've learned, because it's you look at it and you think, oh, it should be yearn, but it's too I can't fit yearn. Oh, I know, yen. If you do crosswords, that's my top tip to you. Yen is a great short replacement for yearn that people seem to use a lot in crosswords.
Anyway. Also, the other word is aria. Just stick aria. Oh, yeah. It's four aria letters. And always, it's aria.
Yeah. Anyway. they're heading to find this strange other. And when they find it, old TQ is there. Fight breaks out, but Lucy beats it badly enough that it runs away.
Score one for the good guys.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the fact that Turtle Queen is here, though, shall we?
It's time for the obligatory Turtle Queen, can we trust her?
Yeah.
Talk every time
she shows up. I mean, for sure, right? Like, every time she shows up, she seems sus to me, and this is not no exception. She still seems like she's on side, but who knows?
Yeah, the tidbit we do get is that she's officially signed on to, like, the town council.
Mm.
Which, like, doesn't that come with oaths not to fuck up the town? Like, you know, we saw, like, the goblins being sworn in back in Arc 5 and stuff. Like, and she's been around for a few months now. So, like, I'm tentatively like, well, if we can't trust her, she's at least waiting for something. Which, it might be something to do with Rook, because she does still presumably work for Rook or whatever.
Mm.
But, I'm kind of going the other way. I think for the first time, I'm tentatively like, I don't think we have to worry about the Turtle Queen, at least right now.
Mm. Yeah. I agree. Like, she seems like she's on the right side for now.
Yeah. Well, the fact that she took the oath for the council is what I'm really clinging to, is like, she said she won't just fuck over the town.
Mm.
And there's probably ways for her to get around that with the whole, like, it's in my nature shit that we've seen before, but. She's at least waiting for something before she kicks it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who knows what that something's going to be, but I can't wait. then we get this other, and that's quite interesting. The confirmation that it can kill Grandfather and Angel, I think, is very spooky. It really feels like a bastardization of the natural order, which is always a fun one to get.
Yeah, that was like the real oh shit moment for me. Like the fact that it could kill those two is like, oh, that's really not good. That said, Lucy doesn't feel very afraid in this fight, right? Like she just kind of takes him. Oh yeah,
she seems
on.
Really on top of it.
Yeah, like you know, and like we've seen her do that in fights. So I don't know. It's like, again, I guess, you know, we talked so much in 19.1 about how this was like the time skip victory lap for Verona. And well, I think 19.2 is less of a victory lap for Lucy. This is very much a, like, well, this is our where is Lucy after the time skip. And she's doing well in a number of ways, including, yeah, like, you know, this is the sort of thing I guess I was thinking of when I talked about her being like that person you send to sort shit out sort of vibe. Like, you know, she comes in here and tries to talk with her or whatever, and when that doesn't work, she can comfortably beat the shit out of it.
Yeah, she's on top of it. She's clearly, becoming this wonderful duelist, and that's very fun.
Mm. So I'm just remembering as well, actually, like way back in the day, I remember like we used to talk about what Verona's specialty might be. Mm. And I think we used to think she'd be like the person who just connected like she was going to be a middleman between like others and practitioners to connect people who needed each other.
Right. Yeah.
And like her peddling is not like too far from that. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really fits with the vibe she had early in the story of the person who just wanted to like, share the practice and share the wonders of this world. And this has just turned into the bookstore version of that in a really fun way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that works.
yeah,
we've got to see Avery's time skip now. I'm so curious.
Yeah. That has to be what 19.3 is.
I mean, surely, yeah.
The final thought I had there actually is I remember like Arc 14 was the last time we had one of these. And it was, I remember it was like a really fun, positive vibe from Avery. And then like, oh, Lucy's in trouble. Oh, Verona's in trouble. So the inverse of the pattern is obviously this one is now, oh, Verona's doing great. Oh, Lucy's doing pretty good too. And then 19.3, oh, Avery's going to have gone to, she's falling apart, Thunder Bay. She's broken up with Nora, you know. She's with Janine now. It's all the worst case scenario.
God, can you imagine? Wait, hold on. Breaking up with Nora and being with Janine, I think is the best case scenario. I'm still on the Janine ship.
I don't think that's actually going to be the case.
No, but I don't think so either, hopefully.
It's a funny line to draw of like imagining, yeah, actually it's all gone to shit for Avery.
Mm.
She now works for Anne.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, coming back to, you know, our resident monster boy who Lucy just beat the shit out of.
Mm.
So we learn that it's like technomantic with some decoration around that. It's presumably like Freeman or Freak or, you know, the guy that Liz hooked up with in her interlude, right?
Yeah, hooked up with is interesting wording, but yeah.
Well, you know, because they teamed up.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, because like I think we heard in 19.1 that the arcade got fucked up, which was one of the things Liz and Freak said that he'd do. So, like, I assume Freak is going to be, you know, a little pain in, like, behinds for this arc, I guess.
Yeah, I'm assuming so. I mean, it seems like it's Freak, yeah.
I mean, we just don't know of any other technomancers apart from Zed, and it's not Zed. I mean, that would be a twist. Yeah. Like maybe this is just how we like sort of get more openly antagonistic to Liz if we find out that she, if the others find out that she teamed up with Freeman like this.
Mm, yeah. We'll see. But I think that's probably right. But yeah, that's the end of our chapters for today.
This is going to be a fun arc. I can already tell. I mean, I suppose that's probably a given. It's not like the first 18 were particularly, you know, laid back, but. Yeah, I'm very excited for this.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, though, just a reminder that we still have our Pale Predictor spreadsheet. So if you want to predict what has Avery been up to in the time skip, for example, or if you want to predict what are the four judge replacements or any of this kind of stuff, the place to go is in the Pale Predictor form, which you'll find linked in the show notes down below.
Yep. The other place to go is obviously the discussion thread for this episode, because we're in the middle of our discussion question, which is, if you were a goblin, what do you think your shtick might be?
Yes.
And we've got some great answers.
Already seeing some good ones in there, yeah. Yeah, so leave that in the discussion thread. And if you want to see some great memes, head to @PaleReflectCast on Twitter, because that's where we post new, fresh, pale memes each and every day.
Ruben's been prepping all those, I'm assuming, if he's making statements like this.
So head on over there and enjoy.
Yes, don't forget to stop by the doofmedia.com website if you want to learn more about just the other shit that's going on at Doof. There's a bunch of cool shit on this network, you know.
Yep.
There's like all sorts of fan art contests going on. So if you're an artist, you can make some dough drawing cool shit.
Yep.
There's also obviously all the great other shows. We've got Ward was back actually like last week. We didn't talk about that, but Scott and Matt came back and did a 2-year retrospective sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So check that out. Or if you want the exclusive bonus stuff, you can head on to Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. We just released our new bonus episode, did we? Or would that was maybe a little bit? No, it was like last week, wasn't it?
It was quite late, yeah. Not long ago, yeah.
Which was on a absolutely great movie called The Mummy Returns.
I can't do this movie again. It is a good movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's what I'm saying, Elliot. It's really good.
I hate you.
And you can check out our episode on that movie by going to patreon.com/doofmedia.
Don't forget to stop by Wabo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wabo, or he'll start writing an F-tier book for Verona's bookstore.
Oh, I like that. I was going to say, or else he'll do a time skip over all your favorite parts and he'll just skip right to the end of the story. So if you don't want that, make sure you support Wabo's Patreon.
Yeah, instead of he's gonna delete the 19.3 draft he's got right now and just change it to like in 19.end.
No, he's going to go even further. If you don't support him, he's going to delete all the chapters except for the prologue and the final chapter. It's going to be Louise at the very start, and then it'll be, you know, 20.x. And now the story's wrapped up. Anyway, have a good weekend, everyone, and catch you around. Yeah, he'll delete everything except the prologue and Far Cry 14.12. anyway, goodbye.
See ya.